Penguin Random House Audio presents Chatter, the voice in our head, why it matters, and how to harness it. This is the author, Ethan Cross. To Dad, for teaching me to go inside, and Lara, Maya, and Danny, my ultimate chatter antidotes. The biggest challenge, I think, is always maintaining your moral compass. Those are the conversations I'm having internally. I'm measuring my actions against that inner voice that, for me at least, is audible, is active. It tells me where I think I'm on track and where I think I'm off track. Barack Obama. The voice in my head is an asshole. Dan Harris. Introduction. I stood in the darkness of my living room, my knuckles white, my fingers tense around the sticky rubber handle of my Little League baseball bat, staring out the window into the night, trying desperately to protect my wife and newborn daughter from a madman I had never met. Any self-awareness about how this looked, or about what I might actually do if the madman appeared, had been washed away by the fear I was experiencing. The thoughts racing through my head kept repeating the same thing. It's all my fault, I said to myself. I have a healthy, adorable new baby and wife upstairs who love me. I've put them both at risk. What have I done? How am I going to fix this? These thoughts were like a horrible carnival ride I couldn't get off. So there I was, trapped, not just in my dark living room, but also in the nightmare of my own mind. Me, a scientist who directs a laboratory that specializes in the study of self-control, an expert on how to tame unrelenting negative thought spirals, staring out the window at 3 a.m. with a tiny baseball bat in my hands, tortured not by the boogeyman who sent me a deranged letter, but by the boogeyman inside my head. How did I get here? The letter and the chatter. That day began like any other day. I woke up early, got dressed, helped feed my daughter, changed her diaper, and quickly down breakfast. Then I kissed my wife and headed out the door to drive to my office on the University of Michigan's campus. It was a cold but tranquil, sunny day in the spring of 2011, a day that seemed to promise equally tranquil, sunny thoughts. When I arrived at East Hall, the mammoth brick-covered building that houses the University of Michigan's storied psychology department, I found something unusual in my mailbox. Sitting atop the stack of science journals that had been accumulating was an envelope hand-addressed to me. Curious about what was inside, it was rare that I received hand-addressed mail at work, I opened the letter and began reading it as I walked toward my office. That's when, before I even realized how hot I was, I felt a rush of sweat slide down my neck. The letter was a threat, the first one I had ever received. The previous week, I had appeared briefly on CBS Evening News to talk about a neuroscience study that my colleagues and I had just published, demonstrating that the links between physical and emotional pain were more similar than previous research had suggested. In fact, the brain registered emotional and physical pain in remarkably similar ways. Heartbreak, it turned out, was a physical reality. My colleagues and I had been excited about the results, yet didn't expect them to generate more than a handful of calls from science journalists looking to file a brief story. Much to our surprise, the findings went viral. One minute I was lecturing to undergraduates on the psychology of love, and the next I was receiving a crash course in media training in a television studio on campus. I managed to get through the interview without tripping on my words too many times, and a few hours later, the segment on our work aired. A scientist's 15 minutes of fame, which in fact amounted to about 90 seconds. What exactly our research had done to offend the letter writer wasn't clear, but the violent drawings, hateful slurs, and disturbing messages that the text contained left little to my imagination about the person's feelings towards me, while at the same time leaving much to my imagination about what form such malice could take. To make matters worse, the letter didn't come from a distant locale. A quick Google search of its postmark revealed that it was sent from just a dozen miles away. My thoughts started spinning uncontrollably. In a cruel twist of fate, I was now the one experiencing emotional pain so intense it felt physical. Later that day, after several conversations with university administrators, I found myself sitting in the local police station, anxiously awaiting my turn to speak to the officer in charge. Although the policeman I eventually shared my story with was kind, he wasn't particularly reassuring. He offered three pieces of advice: call the phone company and make sure my home telephone number wasn't listed, keep an eye out for suspicious people hanging around my office, and, my personal favorite, drive home from work a different way each day to ensure that no one learned my routine. That was it. They were not deploying a special task force. I was on my own. It was not exactly the comforting response I had hoped to hear. As I took a long, circuitous route home that day through Ann Arbor's tree-lined streets, I tried to come up with a solution for how to deal with the situation. I thought to myself, let's go over the facts. Do I need to worry? What do I need to do? According to the police officer and several other people I had shared my story with, there were clear ways I could answer these questions. No, you don't need to stress out over this. These things happen. There isn't anything else you can do. It's okay to be afraid. Just relax. Public figures receive empty threats all the time, and nothing happens. This will blow over. But that wasn't the conversation I had with myself. Instead, the despairing stream of thoughts running through my head amplified itself in an endless loop. What have I done? My inner voice shouted, before switching into my inner frenzy maker. Should I call the alarm company? Should I get a gun? Should we move? How quickly can I find a new job? A version of this conversation repeated itself again and again in my mind over the next 2 days, and I was a nervous wreck as a result. I had no appetite, and I talked endlessly and unproductively about the threatening letter with my wife, to the point that tension between us began to grow. I startled violently each time I heard the faintest peep escape from my daughter's nursery, instantly assuming that the worst fate was upon her, rather than a more obvious explanation: a creaky crib, a gassy baby. And I paced. For 2 nights, while my wife and daughter slept peacefully in their beds, I stood watch downstairs in my pajamas with my Little League baseball bat in my hands, peeking out the living room window to make sure no one was approaching, with no plan for what I would do if I actually found someone lurking outside. At my most embarrassing, when my anxiety peaked on the second night, I sat down in front of my computer and considered performing a Google search with the keywords "bodyguards for academics." Absurd in hindsight, but urgent and logical at the time. Going inside. I'm an experimental psychologist and neuroscientist. I study the science of introspection at the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory, a lab I founded and direct at the University of Michigan. We do research on the silent conversations people have with themselves, which powerfully influence how we live our lives. I've spent my entire professional career researching these conversations, what they are, why we have them, and how they can be harnessed to make people happier, healthier, and more productive. My colleagues and I like to think of ourselves as mind mechanics. We bring people into our lab to participate in elaborate experiments, and we also study them in the wild of daily human experience. We use tools from psychology and other disciplines, fields as diverse as medicine, philosophy, biology, and computer science, to answer vexing questions like, why are some people able to benefit from focusing inward to understand their feelings, while other people crumble when they engage in the exact same behavior? How can people reason wisely under toxic stress? Are there right and wrong ways to talk to yourself? How can we communicate with people we care about without stoking their negative thoughts and emotions or increasing our own? Do the countless voices of others we encounter on social media affect the voices in our minds? By rigorously examining these questions, we've made numerous surprising discoveries. We've learned how specific things we say and do can improve our inner conversations. We've learned how to pick the locks of the magical back doors of the brain, how certain ways of employing placebos, lucky charms, and rituals can make us more resilient. We've learned which pictures to place on our desks to help us recover from emotional injuries. Hint, photos of Mother Nature.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?